Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual to protect the country that we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, we're going to begin today's program, as we often do, by talking about the main thing, the Chinese Communist Party and the threat that it represents, not just to the United States, but really to the world. And who better to consult with than a man who has studied it closely for some time in China itself, as the first Western social scientist to gain access to the place, and in the process to discover firsthand the true horror of what the Chinese Communist Party represented to its own people, not just us. Excuse me. I knew that was coming. Let me just finish that thought. To its own people, as well as to the rest of us. His name is Stephen Mosier. He is a founder of the marvelous Population Research Institute and the author of several important books, including Bully of Asia, and the forthcoming one entitled The Devil and Communist China. Can't wait to get our hands on that. It's available now for pre-order, I'm told, and will be published in March. Steve, it's great to have you with us, sir. Welcome once again.
Well, it's good to be with you again, Frank.
Steve, you are a member of our Committee on the Present Danger China and have been a very important contributor to its work over the several years we've been in business. And I wanted to thank you for that, but also to draw on some of the insights that you've shared with us in that context about the totalitarian nature of the Chinese Communist Party and what it has meant for its own people and for, among other things, the kind of prosperity that they could otherwise enjoy were it not for the brutal control that the CCP, especially under Xi Jinping, has exercised. I was seeing earlier today that Moody's has downgraded the risk rating, I guess, of Communist China. Connect these dots for us, if you would.
Well, the communist revolutions always devour their own. And of course, we think of that in the context of the early years of the Soviet Union, the early years of the People's Republic of China under Chairman Mao, when in purge after purge, the rich peasants were destroyed, the landlords, so-called, were destroyed, people who owned small amounts of land, the reactionaries were destroyed, the capitalists were destroyed, one class after another destroyed, and their wealth confiscated by the state. But we have a new wave of confiscation occurring and expropriation occurring, this time not of the capitalists so much as of the Communist Party members themselves, who are all corrupt. You know, you mentioned that China would be doing much better were it a free and democratic country, because then the natural entrepreneurial ability of the Chinese people would be allowed to express itself. I would argue that over the last 70 years, the Chinese Communist Party has contributed nothing but heartache, has been nothing but an anchor, a weight, a millstone around the necks of the Chinese people, preventing them from progressing as rapidly as they would have otherwise. Yeah. All of the advances.
Well, that's just one part of it, as you know, Steve, so well, because you've documented and contributed to our book that is entitled The Indictment and talks about the crimes the Chinese Communist Party and its friends have committed against, well, us, yes, but also against the people of China and the horrific carnage that it's wrought. So it's not just that they haven't allowed them to fulfill their potential, as have, for example, the people of Taiwan, but they've been brutally, brutally repressed and in many cases murdered. But carry on.
And that has now been turned by Xi Jinping against the Communist Party itself. The internal purge that is ongoing in China is being carried out not only to remove people who are opposed to Xi Jinping, suspected of disloyalty to the supreme leader. It's also a means of funding the government, Frank. This is very odd when you think about it in the first place. But remember that over the last few decades, about 1/6 of all of the gross national product of China has been stolen by Communist Party members. So that means your average county official in China, there are 3,000 counties in China, has tens of millions of dollars in wealth. The average prefectural official in charge of a prefecture, a dozen or so counties, has several hundred million dollars or a billion, and up the chain of command. So much has been stolen by Communist Party members themselves that this is now a lucrative way of funding the government. Millions and millions of Chinese Communist Party officials have been charged with corruption. You can, in fact, charge everyone with corruption if you wanted to, including Xi Jinping himself, who through his brother-in-law and sister have overseas accounts with billions of dollars in them. But this is producing an enormous revenue stream for the government, which I argue is helping to keep China afloat in the middle of the biggest financial crises in China since the Great Leap Forward. And this is not going to end well.
Whose money are they using to do that, by the way?
Whose money? Well, they're taking money from when you arrest a provincial level official, and you confiscate his wealth, you lock him up for decades, or you execute him. And we're talking about $1 billion in wealth, or hundreds of millions of dollars in wealth. So multiply that by a million arrested officials, and you produce $1 trillion in revenue for the central government, which helps to fund its military expansion, which helps to fund the government. It's an incredible thing. We talk about revolutions devouring their own. Now they are literally doing that in China. And of course, we don't want to be funding this system as it collapses under the weight of its own contradictions.
Yeah, propping it up, basically. And that's what I was also going to ask you about is the money, our money, that is being expended for that purpose, Stephen. We're going to talk after a short break here in a moment about what all this means for the rest of the world. But just to finish the thought with respect to China, is there a possibility now, do you think, if we don't intervene to help the Chinese Communist Party weather this rough sledding, that the people of China would be able to overthrow the party?
Well, the Chinese Communist Party is taking this self-cannibalism to a new level. And you can imagine the unrest, the loathing, the fear in China on the part of Communist Party members for Xi Jinping, who has been carrying out this ongoing purge and confiscation of their wealth. And if American investors would stop funding this government, this tyrannical regime, and they should stop funding it, because unless they want to be the main course at the ongoing dismantling of the Chinese economy banquet, they'd be well advised to decline the invitation to continue investing in China. We should not be allowing Chinese companies to list on the U.S. stock exchange. Investors should ask themselves this. China has the second largest economy in the world. It has plenty of very wealthy people. Why can't China's companies find financing within their own country? Why can't Chinese companies raise sufficient capital at home? Or to put it another way, what do the Chinese know about their own companies that Americans don't know? And it turns out there's a lot.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and one of the things that has been so galling about all of this, there's talk about, an impeachment of Joe Biden. It's not clear that adequate attention is being focused on all he's done for the Chinese Communist Party. Yes, some bribes and so on. But one of the main things, as you know, Steve, is in May of 2013, he helped engineer a deal that gave the Chinese sweetheart privileged access to our capital markets. And that has, in turn, I think, helped enrich, some on Wall Street and certainly some in China, but at the greatest of peril, I think, to us as well as the people of China, in terms of its propping up the Chinese Communist Party previously and doing more of it now. Stay tuned. We're going to be right back with more with Steve Mosher on the other side of this break, the author of The Bully of Asia, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The third Obama-Biden administration is waging war on women, while its operatives are clearly weaponizing so-called abortion rights in the hope of attracting female voters, like the often devastating effects on many women of voluntarily terminating their pregnancies. The net impact of the agenda being pursued by leftists and their standard bearers is the antithesis of anything remotely feminist. To cite but a few examples, Michelle Obama and her fellow progressives are AWOL on the Sharia supremacist gang rape, torture, genital mutilation, other dismembering, and mass murder of Israeli women. They and their governmental allies champion so-called transgender men's destruction of women's sports and their privacy and safety in showers, locker rooms, and dormitories. And the administration endorses young girls abandoning their sex through chemical and physical mutations. Far from empowering women, Obama-Biden 3.0 is endangering them. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and Steve Mosier is in the house with us virtually. He is the author of, among other things, The Bully of Asia, and runs the Population Research Institute. Steve, you were talking about the difficulties Xi Jinping is having at home, and the possibility that the Chinese Communist Party's rule may be coming to an unraveling end. When totalitarians face this kind of challenge, as you know, sometimes they eat their own, but sometimes they lash out as a means of justifying the kind of repression and sacrifice that they insist on their people providing. To the extent that Xi is certainly signaling to the Chinese that war is at hand, and they better be preparing for it, and they better be understanding that there will be sacrifices. And to the extent beyond that, that he's seemingly setting what I think of as sort of strategic brush fires around the world, or even conflagrations. It all seems to me to be pointing in the direction that lashing out is what Xi has in mind doing, maybe not just towards Taiwan, but maybe even towards us. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, people always need to remember that the communist parties are war parties. And the Chinese Communist Party is certainly a war party. By that, I mean it's organized along military lines. It runs a command economy. It's always prepared to use every resource at its disposal to crush not only domestic opposition, but to expand its writ, to engage in aggressive acts around the world. That's the very nature of this hateful ideology, and the very nature, I think, of Xi Jinping himself, who is, like Mao Zedong himself, a chaos agent. Mao once said that great chaos leads to great opportunities. So he was very much in the business of creating chaos around in the civil war, in the Kuomintang, in the nationalist-run cities, creating as much chaos as he could by fifth column work, by taking over, by assassinations, by running newspapers, propaganda outlets in those areas when he could. China's doing the same thing around the world. It's using those same united front tactics. But I think more is going on than even that. I note the other day that Wuhan, the famous city that where we first learned about COVID-19, had a planned power outage that lasted for many, many hours, which in my view was, why do you turn off the lights? Imagine turning off the lights in New York City for 12 hours. Why would you do that? Well, in my view, it's a civil defense drill to do two things: to instill obedience in the population in the event of domestic unrest, or in the event of a Taiwan invasion. You can simply lock down people in their homes. That was, I think, part of the reason for the lockdowns as well in Shanghai last year. They didn't need to lock down Shanghai. They did it, I think, to show that they could. They did it as a sort of civil defense drill to show the Chinese people who was in charge, and to remind them they must instantly obey when the Chinese Communist Party sends down a command. So these kinds of drills happening in China, in cities like Wuhan, are very, very worrisome to me, because they do suggest that planning is underway for aggressive acts overseas. And make no mistake, if the situation gets bad enough at home, Xi Jinping will strike out abroad, thinking that he can get a boost in popularity by engaging in some sort of foreign adventure, especially against Taiwan or the hated, well, I say the hated Japanese, the Chinese Communist Party for 70 years has consistently sowed hate against the Japanese for what they did in World War II. They've kept that memory alive in the minds of the Chinese people.
Yeah. This is part of the manipulation and conquer strategy. Absolutely. And Steve, one of the things that I'd like to just tease out with you a little bit from what you said, especially in light of something we're going to talk about later in the program with Kevin Freeman, in the context of the central bank digital currency, is what the digital gulag, a term our friend Reggie Littlejohn has coined, represents in terms of a control mechanism that is obviously going to be very handy if what they're trying to do is to assure that everybody conforms, does what they're told, especially in the event of an invasion of Taiwan. Could you talk a little bit about this social credit system and what it amounts to at present, let alone what it might ultimately become?
Well, a social credit system is nothing more than a political credit system. It's a scoring mechanism by which the Chinese Communist Party is trying to track the thinking of all of the over 1 billion people in China about political topics, about the regime. It's trying to judge whether or not they're following the party line. And what they do is they look to see look at your profile on the internet to see who you're texting, who you're communicating with, who you're looking at on the Weibo and the other social media in China, and who you what kind of stores you visit, what kind of things you buy, what kind of movies you watch, what kind of things you retweet, and that is all put together into a score that rates you as anything from a devoted follower of the regime, which would give you a top score, or someone who is suspect of having treasonous thoughts, which would give you a very low score. And everything is based on that score. Everything. People who want to get a low interest rate loan to buy a house or a car, if they have a high social credit score, they can get a loan. If they have a low social credit score, they can't get a loan at any interest rate. The government will simply deny them access to capital. So it's kind of like our own, and I believe the idea came from our own credit reporting agencies. The Chinese Communist Party looked at those credit reporting agencies and thought, this is a great mechanism, not to just monitor and help banks decide who's creditworthy and who's not. It's also now being used in China to let the political party decide who's politically reliable and who's not. So it's been expanded beyond all reason. A great mechanism of political control. Imagine being denied capital. You're cut off from digital currency. You can't even get on the subway if the subway doesn't take cash anymore, if it's a totally digital economy. You can't go anywhere. You can't buy anything. They can literally starve you to death in your apartment. And you're helpless to fight back.
And Steve, one of the great concerns that, again, Reggie and I and others, I'm sure you have, is the evidence that this social credit score infrastructure is now being exported as part of a kind of softer way by the Chinese Communist Party to achieve the same end of global dominion, namely by virtue of having essentially a digital medical card issued by the World Health Organization as part of its global governance scheme, and empowering it to essentially use it to surveil and monitor and ultimately control people around the world. How serious a risk do you reckon that represents?
Well, I think these unaccountable international bureaucracies are always a serious threat to our freedom. They're essentially not responsive to popular pressure. The leaders don't have to sit for election, re-election from time to time. They're totally unaccountable, and they're given billions of dollars and enormous power and operate out of sight without any transparency of the general public. And they would not hesitate to restrict, you know, our freedoms in every possible way.
In fact, we saw them do that in the yes. recent pandemic, did we not?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And you've written a book on the subject of the pandemic. Remind me what it's called.
The book is called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Pandemics. And if I could say one thing about that, there is a new disease that has been spreading like wildfire across China. What is curious to me, Frank, is that we should be able to have had a sample of that virus by now in our labs. We should have deconstructed it, did genomic analysis, and found out if it's something new, if it's something we have a natural or crossover immunity to, if it's something that, that we can protect ourselves against using things like ivermectin and chloroquine.
Sounds like something that we won't find out about until after the election of 2024. And in the meantime, it will be used as a means of cracking down on us. Steve, we have to get back to you to explore this in greater detail. Thank you for joining us today and all the great work you do. Especially appreciate your new book, The Devil and Communist China. Come back to us soon, if you would. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and we're joined by one of my favorite guests from Canada, north of the border. It's her home, and it's a country that we're endlessly interested in because it seems it might have sort of an indication of where we're headed if we're not careful. So we're always delighted to be able to catch up with Christine Douglas-Williams. She is an author, a prize-winning host as well as producer of television programming. Among her books is The Challenge of Modernizing Islam by Encounter Books, and one by the Center for Security Policy Press, I'm very pleased to say, one entitled Fired by the Canadian Government for Criticizing Islam. She is also an associate editor with Front Page Magazine, the David Horowitz Freedom Center's wonderful online resource, as well as one of my favorite resources, and that would be Robert Spencer's jihadwatch.org. It's great to have you back, Christine, as always. We're going to talk a little bit about the challenges of dealing with Islam, not just criticizing it, but and not all Muslims, but the Sharia supremacist kind. I caught a very important piece you had the other day that talked a bit about what Gaza was like before Israel made it essentially a Palestinian state, and what it's like now that it is one.
Frank, it's always great to join you. It's sad to say it's always on these topics that are quite heart-wrenching. Exactly. But a lot of people just don't realize what Gaza was like before the Jews were thrown out in these agreements. And, you know, we've heard it said, why does Israel keep giving up land? Every single time it's given up land, it's come to catastrophe. What happens is they end up being attacked from that same land that they surrendered. And if you were to look...
Can I just calibrate one thing, though, Christine? It wasn't so much that they were thrown out as the government of Israel, in its wisdom under Ariel Sharon, voluntarily agreed to abandoned the place, and then forced, you know, extracted, I think is a better term for it. Yes. People who didn't want to go and were leaving behind an awful lot of very important infrastructure, which goes to your next point.
It's good you corrected that, lest it be misconstrued. But from the people's perspective, they were actually forcibly removed. And when you look at what they had done, it is heartbreaking. These people had turned Gaza into a showpiece. It was an agricultural glory. It was exporting goods. The place was green, like a little heaven. Yeah. And they had
greenhouses in particular abounded.
Yes, right? And they had farmland. They had farm animals. They had created an intricate infrastructure underground for the farming equipment, and of course made of metals. And you can guess what happened once they left. And it was taken over. Gaza was taken over by the Palestinians, governed by Hamas. Yeah. They took that
and that infrastructure. I think the point that you were getting at there in your piece, particularly Christine, is that that basically meant that they had the makings of a quite developed state if they'd chosen to not only maintain it, obviously, but to build upon it. What did they do instead, even before Hamas took over?
And what they did instead, they ripped up the entire infrastructure, took the materials to make weaponry, because their focus is death to the infidel, death to Israel, death to Zionists. And it showed.
The Jews, most especially. Yeah. And so, Christine, to the extent that we're told that, again, the source of all of Gaza's problems is an Israeli occupation, which is crazy, but also this idea that it's an open air prison because the Israelis have confined them. It sounds from what you're saying as though it was a function of choices that the Palestinians made, again, in part even before they elected Hamas to govern them.
If you look at the original, Frank, this is something you deal with, Muslim Brotherhood. You deal with all these issues with jihad specifically. And we know not every Muslim is into that, but that is what the Sharia is. That's what the expansionary nature of Islam is. If you look at all the founding charters governing the Palestinian territories, we're focused on Hamas now, but all of them, the goal was and still is to obliterate the state of Israel. The Palestinian Authority is no different. Hamas has it in its covenant. If you look at the Palestinian National Covenant, it talks about obliterating Israel. Israel has been marked. It is the only democracy in the Middle East of which was conquered by Islamic supremacists, by jihadists. We need to remember that Egypt was 99% Christian before it was taken over. This is something that people do not realize. And the way the media is parading deaths with the Gaza children. I mean, nobody wants to see children dying, but let's remember here, the deadliest war in history was World War II, where 40 million civilians died. Who parades that? War is awful. It is hellish. And to make matters
and
worse,
a very substantial killed. Number of them, to be honest, died at yes. our hands, including women and children.
That's
and
right.
We did it because we had to destroy our mortal enemies, the Nazis and the Imperial Japanese. And if Israel does anything less, not that we're encouraging the deliberate attacks on civilians or women and children, most especially, and we're not, and Israel is not doing that, Christine, of course, as you know, but what rather instead we need to make sure of is that they are not defeated yes. by all of these people who are insisting that they must behave a lot differently than we did. When our lives were on the line, we thought. Christine, we could go on about this, but I did want to touch with you on another subject, if we may turn to something going on in a different part of the across the pond world, and namely in the United Kingdom. You've done some digging into the character who has been recently plucked from post ministerial obscurity by the current Prime Minister of Britain to be his foreign minister. Remind us who that individual is and what we know about his background that should be quite troubling given his present portfolio.
It is very troubling. First of all, we need to remember, Frank, that Rishi Sunak was not elected by the people. It was, and that is something we need to also remember. It was Liz Truss, the shortest term in the history of Britain. But this new appointment, we need to also remember David Cameron, he's the new appointment as foreign secretary. And we need to remember that when he quit, this was in relation to Brexit, which was...
When he left the Prime Minister's office.
Right, he gave it up. It was a disaster in Britain, what was going on. And they voted with the, Brexit. Yeah. So
effectively, he was forced out over it, as I recall.
Exactly. Yeah. But you see, now he's coming out of retirement to serve. And people don't realize what this guy is bringing to the table. He has an enormous connection with China. In fact, since he quit in scandal, he's been involved in various China-related initiatives. And that includes working to set up a $1 billion UK-China investment fund. And it's aimed at supporting China's Belt and Road Initiative. He lobbied for foreign investment.
Inside the United Kingdom.
And he lobbied for foreign investment for the Colombo Port City project in Sri Lanka, which of course is backed by China. In fact, China already put in $1.4 billion into the development. And he was quoted on a website as saying that it is a sea of opportunity that will help in building bridges and bringing greater prosperity for all. So this appointment has observers.
Sounds like propaganda out of the Chinese Communist Party, doesn't it?
In fact, absolutely. There was a warning by a guy named Luke de Pulford. He's executive director of the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China. And he said right out that this appointment of Cameron, it's hard to see, he says, who wins from the appointment except Beijing. So we need to be watching Britain. When everybody is watching one end of the globe, something else is going on at the same time with the same enemies or worse.
Yeah, Christine, one of our theses at the moment is that Xi Jinping is in fact deliberately distracting us from the main thing, which is of course his own coming aggression against Taiwan and probably others of us, including almost certainly us here in the United States. But, you know, getting away with placing key people among their captured elites, as they call them, to advance agendas like the Belt and Road Initiative inside, you know, one of our most important NATO allies is deeply troubling. You're absolutely right, especially because that Belt and Road Initiative, we should be clear, is designed, like as one of our guests, Captain James Fennell, has observed, the game of Go, which the Chinese are masters of, which is essentially a game of strategy, which has you putting positions in place that enable you to dominate the board and deny your opponent success. And in this case, that's what this Belt and Road Initiative is all about, I'm convinced. And to have a man who has been engaged in promoting it, now having the authority and position of the foreign minister of the United Kingdom, is a very serious problem. And I so appreciate you calling it to our attention and warning about it, as you do at jihadwatch.org and at Front Page Magazine very regularly, and to your great credit, Christine. I'm sorry we're out of time, but it's most important that I think we both get the truth about what's going on in Hamasstan, as I think of it now, Gaza, and also in the United Kingdom, because unfortunately there are symptoms of this much larger problem that that strategic arsonist Xi Jinping is conducting aggressively. Keep up the great work, my friend. Come back to us soon, if you would. In the meantime, stay well. We'll be right back with more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The third Obama-Biden administration is waging war on women, while its operatives are clearly weaponizing so-called abortion rights in the hope of attracting female voters, like the often devastating effects on many women of voluntarily terminating their pregnancies. The net impact of the agenda being pursued by leftists and their standard bearers is the antithesis of anything remotely feminist. To cite but a few examples, Michelle Obama and her fellow progressives are AWOL on the Sharia supremacist gang rape, torture, genital mutilation, other dismembering, and mass murder of Israeli women. They and their governmental allies champion so-called transgender men's destruction of women's sports and their privacy and safety in showers, locker rooms, and dormitories. And the administration endorses young girls abandoning their sex through chemical and physical mutations. Far from empowering women, Obama-Biden 3.0 is endangering them. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to my next guest, a man who I consider to be a dear friend, as well as one of the most important contributors to our side's efforts to secure freedom in this world. He brings to it an extraordinary background in the study of practice of economic warfare, the subject of his extraordinarily important television program, Economic War Room, with Kevin Freeman. Kevin is, of course, the host as well as our guest now. And I just wanted to say, in addition to how much I appreciate the work that he does in that television outlet, his various published contributions from Secret Weapon, his first book, to the most recent of his books, save for one, According to Plan, and the one that we'll be talking with him about today, brand new, entitled Pirate Money, are all incredibly important content for anybody who wishes to, in fact, not only enjoy freedom, but to help secure it. And Kevin, I did want to just say a personal word. I was an admirer of your father. I know how proud he was of the work that you have been doing and how deeply you admired as well as loved him. And I'm so sorry on the occasion of his recent passing. And just wanted to say that on behalf, I think, of all of us who appreciate you and you and your family and the work that you do. So got that off my chest. Let me just turn, if I can, to a bit of problem setting, level setting about a problem is a better way to put it. We have, I think, now increasing evidence that something you've been warning about for decades is very far advanced, and that is the loss of the status of reserve currency of the world, of the U.S. dollar, as a result of our profligate expenditures and printing of an awful lot of those dollars. Talk a little bit about that as the context for our conversation about pirate money.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. One is I have a book here. It's titled The Death of the Dollar, written by William Rickenbacker, Eddie Rickenbacker's son. This was published in 1968, and we were at this point of the precipice where the dollar was about to lose its reserve currency status and really all of the dangers associated with that, until a man who just recently passed away, Henry Kissinger, came along and found a way to tie the dollar to oil and the oil trade. And he created the petrodollar mechanism. Now, that's good and bad because it allowed us to continue our profligate spending because everybody had to have a dollar in order to buy oil with it. But with Kissinger's passing away, it's kind of symbolic of the fact that the petrodollar is also dead. And that may have been one of his greatest contributions, for good or for evil, for America. But when he passed away, we now note that the Saudis and the Iranians and other oil-producing nations no longer require dollars.
Yeah. When you even want the United Arab Emirates.
Yes. Yeah. And so the net result of that is that we now see that last prop that had held the dollar up since 1968 when William Rickenbacker proclaimed the death of the dollar until now. So over the last 50 years or so, we are now at risk. We're spending way too much money. We have $34 trillion in debt. People don't want dollars anymore. It's kind of an old-fashioned currency. And then enemies of the United States want to eliminate the use of the dollar globally, like Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping and others. Right. So, yes, the dollar is under threat.
And the so-called BRICS nations as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, 30, some, many of whom are our allies,
right.
have said, well, the U.S. shouldn't have this exorbitant privilege. That's what Charles de Gaulle said, of having the reserve currency, the primary currency. When you think of money, you think of U.S. dollars. Well, that era is ending, and we're entering a new era.
So one of the manifestations of how much that is taking place, as you know, Kevin, is the interest that a lot of those folks, notably the BRICS, a lot of central banks in and out of that informal group, are buying gold, evidently, you know, hand over fist. The prices, as a result, higher, I think, than ever. And the appeal to lots of Americans is increasingly evident as well. The Federal Reserve Board is exacerbating things by continuing to print money, especially since our bonds aren't selling so much. But also they're introducing this so-called central bank digital currency. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that and the downside risks associated with it.
Yeah, well, you have to have an alternative. People will demand some sort of money. So the Chinese have developed their digital yuan. Major nations of the world are creating their own version of central bank digital currency. They're talking about making it interoperable so that it's a one world currency that everyone will be forced into. That is the intention of the World Economic Forum and really the BRICS nations and others, because it is such an enormous control mechanism. If I can control what money is and how it's spent and where it's allowed to be spent and who is allowed to have it and how much they're allowed to have and literally manipulate it and take it in and out of people's accounts, then I control the world.
You bet.
Literally.
Yeah. And that's the idea, I think, at the end of the day. And whether there will be one central bank digital currency that prevails or another, I don't know. But Kevin, one of the things, as you know, that we've been working on, including with your help, is this effort to resist what I think is properly characterized by our friend Reggie Littlejohn as a digital gulag, that things like this World Health Organization empowerment initiative evidently have in mind, whereby, among other things, there will be a digital identity card for every human being on the planet, and it will have not only their health information, but all kinds of other personal data, you know, banking information, employment, and so on. And if they can also put that, put into that mix this vehicle for controlling your money externally, by deciding where you'll spend it and so on, it could be very, very problematic indeed. Kevin, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to ask you a little bit about gold and what the opportunities are there on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned for more with Kevin Freeman right after this. We're back with Kevin Freeman, is with us virtually in-house. We're always pleased to catch up with him, the proprietor of, among other things, the Economic War Room Also, another of my favorite projects is his National Security Investment Consultants Institute, which we'll come back to him to talk more about in the days ahead. But for the moment, we're talking about pirate money, which is the subject of his newest book, a very important how-to manual, in a way, to do something about the kinds of problems we've just been discussing, the devaluation massively of our dollar, the possibility that it will cease to be the world's reserve currency, which would almost certainly cause it to be considerably less valuable, and the possibility that there is another shoe to drop here, namely a central bank digital currency that could literally control you in the wrong hands. All of this is worrying enough, Kevin, as is the question of whether or not one of the safe harbors in this environment is gold at a time when its price is rising rather rapidly. Your thoughts on the advisability of investing in gold? I personally have had the experience that it does increase in value, but the fact that it's not usable is very much a challenge, the transaction ability, I guess it might be called. Walk us through your thoughts as an economic warfare guy, especially.
Yeah, well, Frank, first, I would suggest that gold is not an investment. From the time beginning, gold has been money. It literally is money. It's what our founders thought money was. It's what the Bible speaks of, gold and silver coin, in terms of money. And the idea that we could transact in it is something that's very important. The problem is because it is not transactional at the moment, people view it more like you did, as an investment, a safe harbor, a place to hold things. Well, money has three components. It's a unit of account, it's a means of exchange, and a store of value. Well, today, it really pretty much is relegated to that store of value concept. Still, it's attractive. Central banks are buying it. Individuals are buying it. In fact, how to buy gold was the number one Google search term in April because people were panicked. Inflation's going. Where do I put my money that will be safe and can protect me against the ravages of inflation? So I want gold. Now, if we could take that concept, take it away from the investment and put it back to real money, how would we do that? It'd have to be transactional. How can you spend gold and silver like money? Well, you can't lug around gold bars and gold coins. You can't walk into a coffee shop and shave off, you know, a few flecks of gold to pay for your cup of coffee. So what do you do? Well, there were some innovative entrepreneurs who picked up an idea that I've been talking about really for 40 years, making gold and silver transactional, applying modern technology, the modern banking system of capabilities and so forth, a company called Glent, or there's one called Lode, or there's one called Kinesis. And they literally will take on deposit gold and silver. They'll put it in a Swiss bank or a Cayman Islands bank, and then they will allow you to transact. So every time you walk into a store, you hand them a debit card and you say, I want to buy that cup of coffee. They will sell just enough gold to pay for that cup of coffee and then deliver the proceeds to the merchant. It's a brilliant idea. Now you add to that what Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution says, which is a state can make gold and silver coin legal tender in the state, and you have what I call pirate money. And that's why I wrote the book. It explains exactly legally, practically, how you can make gold and silver transactional money that would be an alternative to the risks of central bank digital currency, an alternative to the risk of the failing dollar as reserve currency. This is a place you can hold your money. Now, if we get this passed and we have 19 states looking at the legislation, there's model legislation in this book, there's practical ways to do it. It's endorsed by some amazing people, including you, Frank, and Naomi Wolf and Ben Carson, and just a whole host of tremendous people who've read the book. And now it is a movement, and people need to read the book, understand the movement, because it will show them how they can own gold and silver outside the traditional system and actually make it transactional.
It's such a cool idea, Kevin, and the book is well written and easily read and has had an unbelievable impact, as I've been learning as you develop these relationships with legislators all over the country who are now in, it seems, increasingly an active competition to see which state is going to be the first to make this transactional gold available. Texas, it would seem, has a leg up in that it has a gold bullion depository that can be, you know, a storehouse for this purpose. But Kevin, just a quick word on, you know, if this is a constitutional undertaking, and I think that was a real breakthrough figuring that out, why is it pirate money, which suggests that it's actually in some way illegal?
Yeah, well, on the back of it, it says pirate money equals patriot money. If you're a student of history in the American Revolution, you understand that pirates helped us win the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812. And you realize that when George Washington and others were dealing in gold and silver coins, they were dealing with gold doubloons from Spain, and they were dealing with pieces of eight from Spain. And if you hear the term gold doubloons and pieces of eight, you think of Captain Jack Sparrow or Long John Silver or Blackbeard, or you think of pirates. And so most of the modern coins or the gold and silver coins that we have from that period would be pirate treasure, or they would be actually transacted money that they used in the colonial period and shortly thereafter. So we call it pirate money. It just helps people recognize it's gold and silver coins like gold doubloons and pieces of eight.
Yeah. And it was pirate money because they took it from the Spanish or others who were mining it and minting it and so on.
Yeah.
And Kevin, just to wrap this up in the space of a minute or so, when you look at this sort of competition, what can individual citizens do right now to encourage their legislators to be the first of the pack?
Very quick. Yeah. Go to piratemoneybook.com, buy a copy, and give it to your personal legislator. We have Utah and Florida and Texas and Alaska. They're all getting books, and they're all moving forward because they've read the book.
Read it and act, I guess, is the alternative to read it and weep. Kevin Freeman, thank you for writing Pirate Money. Thank you for joining us here and for all the great work you do at the Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, Blaze TV, among other places. Come back to us with updates. I hope the rest of you will come back to us next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.